are we normalizing this structure of poorly funded public services, and instead we'll just give through philanthropy to our services as and when we need them? So they're not going to have this consistent funding from kind of taxpayers' money. They'll just have these weird splurges of money every so often and be impossible to actually deliver lasting change.
This is Michelle Shireen Murray, your host and fellow traveler on The Ethical Rainmaker. We're here to explore how to step into our power or step out of the way when we're trying to do good work in nonprofits and fundraising and philanthropy. So excited to bring you season 2. And let me just say, it's been amazing to see this community grow. In the last 6 months since we've launched, we've seen the show being used as curriculum in multiple universities. We're welcoming listeners from all over the world. And it's been really inspiring to hear your messages of support, of reflection, as you listen to these conversations about the third sector and its challenges. Y'all give me energy and life. Thank you so much for listening in. And this season, well, we've got a lot of juicy conversations on the way. We'll dive into conceptual frameworks, work on better tactics and strategies for community centrism in the nonprofit world and beyond, and explore concepts like reparations, restorative justice, and other really crucial topics to our work. So, our fucked up fundraising practices, our relationship to patrons, major donors, those power dynamics, well, they came from somewhere. You know that on the show, we talk about patriarchy, we talk about white supremacy, we talk about capitalism. And in the US, we can trace so many of these practices and oppressions and that history to the land of our ultimate colonizers, England. And I think we can learn a lot from how the UK currently struggles with charities and patronages and see reflections of our own similar issues in North America and wherever we're doing this sort of work. Today, we're talking to Andy King and Tom Dufresne, who are the thoughtful and witty hosts of the UK podcast Fixing Fundraising. Two white dudes who are very aware of the big problems of our sector and channel their analyses through hosting their show. Andy and Tom have a lot in common in that they've each focused their careers in relationships and partnership building. Andy works at Remarkable Partnerships, a small consultancy in the UK helping nonprofits build ambitious public-private partnerships. He's been involved in East African Playgrounds and then Rays of Sunshine. In 2018, he was awarded Best Fundraising Newcomer at the UK National Fundraising Awards and was named in the top 25 under 35 fundraisers by Fundraising Magazine. He is also the chair of trustees at Raising Futures Kenya. Tom is a digital fundraising expert now working in augmented reality and is helping charities, schools, and nonprofits leverage emerging technologies. He's on the board of London-based charity Street Storage, helping people experiencing homelessness find vital access to safe storage of their belongings. Tom has worked across digital fundraising at companies like Blackbaud, JustGiving, and social media for good startup Lightful. On Fixing Fundraising, Andy and Tom have created more than 30 episodes, which offers analyses, diversity of opinions, and inspiration. I love listening to these interviews, and I know you will too, as they allow full conversations to take place with complete honesty. Gentlemen, thank you so much for the work that you do on Fixing Fundraising, and welcome to The Ethical Rainmaker.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Welcome to The Ethical Rainmaker.
I believe this is the bit where we speak. from the land of tea and or colonialism. Hi.
We invented them both, right? Well, I think actually tea was invented by Indian people and colonialism. You know what? That's ours. I think colonialism is ours. We can take that one.
Yeah, I think you can. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the closest thing we have to culture.
Yeah.
It's stealing
really
other
good.
People's.
Yeah, it's really good. It's a really proud legacy of our great country. But really excited to be here, Michelle.
Yeah, so excited to have you. Thank you. Y'all, we have so much to talk about. I love your podcast. I've really been getting deep into the interviews that you do. And again, they're just so touching and inspirational. And it's so great to hear full conversations like that. We so often are just hearing sound bites. So thank you again for the work you do. And we have so much to talk about today. Our audience for The Ethical Rainmaker spans from Sri Lanka to Brazil, from Switzerland to New Zealand. And really, the majority of our listeners are in the US and Canada and slowly expanding. So I'd really like to talk to you today about the UK and how some of the most damaging practices that we see in nonprofits over here in the US and Canada were actually born where you all live. So you've had a bunch of stuff about charity, about fundraising, about philanthropy. A lot of problematic stuff has been coming up in your media. We can start anywhere, but I know that recently the chair of the Charity Commission in the UK is an appointed position, and this person has asked charities to watch their tone and stay out of political conversations. The chair of the Charity Commission is someone called Baroness Stowell, and recently she was interviewed and said, quote, "I've been quite challenging of the charity sector, and I make no apology for that because I care very much about all that it achieves." I would love to hear more about your opinions here.
So I think it's worth, before we get into it, kind of explaining what the Charity Commission is.
Please.
And why the chair of the Charity Commission's statement to charities to not be political is so important. Because it's our understanding that there isn't necessarily a direct equivalent of the Charity Commission in the US. So the Charity Commission is effectively the regulator. It's the government body that check that charities are doing with their money what they're meant to be doing. They check that there's no fraud, they check that there's no corruption, and they check that everything is kind of operating as it should. And in principle, that's a brilliant body to have. It should really help public trust in charity, and it should be something that really keeps everyone moving towards the right goals. And you will notice that I have said should rather than does. Often because of the behavior of the chair of the Charity Commission. And it's super interesting to hear someone who is the chair of the Charity Commission, which is a politically appointed role. So the party in power pick their person to regulate the Charity Commission. So it's a political thing. telling charities not to be political. And especially with the government that we have in play at the moment, the Conservative Party, who are similar in many ways to the Republican Party, it is effectively the chair of the Charity Commission being like, stop picking on my friends, stop saying that the government aren't doing enough because it's the government that have put me here. So I'm going to tell you that you're bad and you're wrong. And that's where the problems start. But there's like a whole bunch of problems that come out of that. From there, Tom, I don't know if you wanted to kind of pick up from that point.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and your explainer really gives that the context of the world that we live in. And the UK is full of regulators for different industries based on political appointments. The thing that really interested me about the Baroness's article in particular was that A, it was written in the Daily Mail, which is a generally speaking, a very right wing publication. It wasn't put anywhere from an official communications point of view. It was put in a very politically leaning, politically active newspaper deliberately, to as a communication to that audience, basically. So, and the thing that really got my attention was the fact that she said party politics, but also culture wars, which is such an interesting statement. It was such an interesting like choice of words when there's so much going on in the world right now about the use of the term culture wars is almost this kind of virtue signaling from the right. And mm-hmm. a lot of right wing organizations use culture war as a kind of dog whistle for some kind of conflict, which I think is really interesting language. And then when you piece it together with it being in the Daily Mail and who it was writing it, it completely blows your mind that the message is don't be political. And it wasn't an official government broadcast, or didn't come from the Charity Commission. It was innately a political statement that was made. And especially as it came out not far after this article, that she wasn't seeking a second term as the chair. So it was almost the here's my fireworks display before I go out, like this weird like scorched earth policy, which sometimes you see from like the Bank of England, which is our big fiat money regulator the Bank of England can sometimes border on political if an outgoing director or an outgoing chair of the Bank of England wants to make a political statement, but it's normally quite delicate. This was really on the nose. And I think during a global pandemic where the charity sector in the UK especially has been really, really hard hit, it just came across as completely tone deaf. Like, she only mentioned the pandemic in the opening paragraph, and then it was like an ending silo of attack on the sector, which, you know, from your regulator, it just seems completely balmy. But it does lend a lot of context to the kind of the landscape that's operating in the UK right now. And it definitely does lean back to what you were saying, Michelle, about the power structures that exist in the kind of political like organization of the UK. The way our kind of charities are set up is this kind of legacy structure from basically the Victorian times, and that's kind of where we find ourselves right now, which is pretty crazy.
And I think it's not only is it tone deaf, but it's really naive to tell charities not to be political, given that as Tom said, our charities are kind of a set up as a legacy from what was set up in the welfare state and what wasn't set up in the welfare state. Most charities are set up to meet a need that people feel the state isn't needing. So Cancer Research UK might not be considered a political charity until you consider that Cancer Research UK only exists because the government isn't putting enough money into cancer research for people to be happy with that. And people are more than happy to donate millions and millions of pounds, which is worth even more if you convert it to dollars, into funding cancer research because they've decided that it's not enough of a political priority. Mm. And it's exactly the same thought process that someone goes through to set up Black Lives Matter, because they think, well, the government isn't prioritizing social justice enough, so I'm going to set up my own social justice organization. But fundamentally, what we're doing when we're setting up a charity is plugging a gap that the state is leaving behind. And so to ask charities to not be political is to ask them to completely ignore their reason for being set up, and ignoring the fact that the state probably in most cases has the power to solve those problems and is actively choosing not to.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's just a completely balmy statement.
Mm. Every act of setting up a charity is a political statement. Some are more political than others in that some will actively campaign for policy changes. But whether it's homelessness or Alzheimer's, it's a political statement. As you say, it says something about the landscape and the economy in which you live in. If you take that statement and say, I'm not happy with the status quo, as soon as you say you're not happy with the status quo, it's a political statement. It's an expression of political will to want to change something. So it does seem crazy that's the kind of that is the landscape that we kind of operate in, and it's just become the norm, is to, you know, don't be political and you get finger wagged if you do it, you get told off by the headmistress, which is not a nice feeling, I'm sure.
Thank you for that. Yeah, there's so much to unpack in what you're uncovering, but Tom, I can't help myself. You talked about the fireworks show that she gave. And honestly, on New Year's Eve, I watched London's fireworks show, which was full of drones.
Yeah.
In a really impressive display. But what I thought was most interesting about London's New Year's Eve fireworks display and drone display was that there really was so much shout out to philanthropy and charity. There was a lot of mention of the NHS, a lot of thank yous to people working on the front lines. There was a nod to one of your new celebrity fundraisers. And what I thought was interesting was that, again, this idea of forcing politics, your mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, took shit for, quote, forcing politics on New Year's Eve, especially because the NHS logo was shown and the Black Lives Matter fist.
Yeah.
You know, like to support the Black Lives Matter movement in coordination with all of the efforts that have happened around the world since the murder of George Floyd here in the US. So I thought that was interesting. I'm wondering if you would speak to any of that.
I mean, as an aside point, I would say that I'm very pro-drone and very anti-firework. Now I've seen what drones can do. They're great. Often people who want to oppose something will kind of label it as political to make people think that it shouldn't happen. So they'll say the Black Lives Matter movement is political. So they'll throw shit, as you say, at the Mayor of London for putting that together, even though it would have been multiple people weighing in on that and thinking about what kind of year we've had and what kind of things should we mention and what kind of things shouldn't we mention, given how many drones we have, what story do we want to tell? And that's what they try to do. Like, people who want to shut that kind of debate down will say, it is political, you can't make this political statement. But it was, I think, arguably more political to put Captain Tom up there, the fundraiser who you mentioned, who is the nation's sweetheart, shall we say. The UK loves him, and rightly so. He's an adorable old man who tried to make a difference and made a political statement by doing that.
A note for the listener. This conversation was recorded just prior to the passing of Captain Tom Moore, who died of complications from COVID-19 on February 2nd, 2021. Just letting you know why we didn't mention his passing in this conversation.
But I think his inclusion... Yeah, his.
Just tell us quickly about that, because I hadn't heard of him until I watched your New Year's Eve show, and then I did some Googling to learn more. I would love to hear from you what his story is.
100%. We'll do it in tandem. I'll tell some of the story, cool. And I will probably omit some out, and Andy will correct me. But he's a record breaking fundraiser and a war veteran. I think he's over 100 years old. Was a captain in the RAF, I believe. And he decided to walk around his garden to raise, I think it was £1,000 originally, not directly for the National Health Service, and this is where it gets a bit murky, but for an organization called NHS Charities Together that supports the kind of tapestry of different organizations that support our National Health Service here in the UK. He ended up raising something like £32 million, which is an incredible amount of money when you look at the financial reporting from NHS Charities Together, and they raised about £500,000 the previous year.
Yeah.
So suddenly their income growth has been exponential, this ridiculous growth, and loads of people are giving because they're moved by the pandemic and they're moved by someone like Captain Tom.
We're talking about fundraising and the challenges of charities in the UK right now on The Ethical Rainmaker. Britain has a system where tax dollars ostensibly pay for a lot more public services than they do here in the US, where I'm based. Yet, they face a lot of issues that might sound familiar to you. Our guests are Andy King and Tom Dufresne, hosts of the podcast Fixing Fundraising. You can find links to their work at fixingfundraising.uk. And again, an important note here. We are talking about beloved UK charity figure Captain Tom, who passed away February 2nd, 2021, at the age of 100. We recorded this conversation shortly before Captain Tom's passing.
The challenge here is it's extremely unpopular to say anything against what he's done, but actually there is an inherently political problem with people who have a National Health Service raising money for that National Health Service when that service should be adequately funded through taxation. And that's the kind of end result there. And taxation is boring and not emotional. And everything Captain Tom did was incredible and emotional and wonderful. And he was given a knighthood from the Queen for it. And, you know, he was kind of celebrated and venerated, and kind of rightly so, for the actions that he took. And he wanted to make a difference. But he stuck his flag in the ground and said, I want to raise this money because clearly the NHS isn't well funded enough. You know, he clearly thought that. He clearly thought, we're not doing enough to support the National Health Service. And the challenge, I think, from his legacy is, are we normalizing this structure of poorly funded public services, and instead we'll just give through philanthropy to our services as and when we need them? So they're not going to have this consistent funding from kind of taxpayers' money. They'll just have these weird splurges of money every so often and be impossible to actually deliver lasting change. So I think it's incredibly difficult to talk about Captain Tom and his legacy without getting into the murky emotional world of what he did. But it does pose a threat, I think, to the way our public services are delivered in the UK. And certainly when a lot of what the British government has been doing over the past 5 years has emulated what the American government is doing and has always done. So I think possibly we've we may have given you the English language and cups of tea, and you've done some crazy things with the English language, might I add. aluminum, what the hell's that? But you've given us back this weird, strange decentralized system of government that means a lot of deregulation is kind of coming our way. And I think that's the Captain Tom thing is kind of indicative of that, really.
Yeah, capitalism is our religion over here. We mm-hmm. have taken it to the next level.
Praise be to capitalism.
Do you mind if I jump in on that? Because there's a couple of bits.
No, are you kidding? I would love that, Andy. Please do.
First of all, I absolutely love that Tom, the tech man, his head, when he thinks about the New Year's Eve political conversation, his first thought is, but what's the drone capacity? Like, that's right? His first thought. Like,
so
we only have
drones.
So many drones. So that's hilarious.
Well, and Tom, you work in the field of augmented reality now, right?
I do. And I work in an emerging market. So as soon as I saw drones, I was like, oh, they're the future. And I get very excited by the kind of latest shiny penny. I make no apologies for that.
Right. So you've got Tom teched out. That's what he first thought of. Yeah. And what did you think of, Andy? Go ahead.
I think I thought of that more political murkiness, in truth. I want to make a quick shout out aside. There's another great UK fundraising podcast called Do More Good. And yes. There's an episode of Do More Good where they interview the CEO of NHS Charities Together, who is the person at the helm of that organization that went from having 500k turnover last year to suddenly 32 million and being like, now what do I do? Which is a fascinating episode. So worth checking out if you're interested in the story specifically of Captain Tom and his impact.
We'll link to it in the show notes.
Awesome. And I think the particular point that Tom made is that the dangerous part of Captain Tom, which is difficult to point out because it looks like you're attacking this really nice old man who did this really nice thing and all these nice people that donated nice money well-intendedly, is it normalizes this behavior that the NHS can be propped up by the people, but the NHS shouldn't be being propped up by the people because we are literally already paying for it in paying our taxes. And kind of that piece that we were talking about earlier about how charities are set up to address the problems of the state. When we were talking about this episode, we were talking about how actually the NHS is one key difference between the UK charity market and the US charity market. In the UK, people like Cancer Research UK are developing specialist and cutting edge cures, but it's 99% of the time the NHS that are administrating those cures. Once the cures are there, they're being rolled out. The NHS are the ones who are responsible for getting people vaccinated from COVID right now. Whereas in the US, where you don't have that nationalized health service, you might rely on charities to help you fund your chemotherapy. You might rely on charities to help you administer your chemotherapy. And that's a complete difference. And by donating to Captain Tom's efforts, and in particular the difficulty of donating to Captain Tom's efforts, thinking that you're donating to the NHS rather than the NHS Charities Together, which is actually a different thing, you're making a statement that it's okay for your additional money outside of your taxes to, for lack of a better word, top up what the government won't pay. And that's right. Really dangerous precedent to set. And if anything, is a political statement that people aren't necessarily thinking through about how political it is. And I don't want to say to people that they shouldn't have donated to Captain Tom. I'm not saying that Captain Tom shouldn't have the incredible recognition that he is. Like, put that man up in drones. No matter how few drones you have, he should go up in drones.
Yeah, drone him.
But like, well, that sounds a lot worse when you say it.
I immediately regret saying drone him to an American audience. Yeah. Immediately.
Just quick pause. We mean put him in drone lights, not...
Yes.
Not bomb him with drones.
Not tomahawk missile him. Definitely don't tomahawk missile him. He's a legend.
Like the US has done so much of. Yeah,
but
it's
nuts that Captain Tom squeaks by... Given, I mean, there's loads of context here about how Brexit, which is this whole other shit show, Brexit and NHS funding has been this massive ongoing conversation where one of the big campaign promises of the Brexit referendum was an extra £350 million a week going to the NHS. And it has been very clear that that was just a lie, that that was just fabricated, that Bojo and his mates got a fag packet. They wrote on the back of it, 350 million. They're like, that sounds right. Let's put it on a bus and drive that bus around the UK. And then when you think about Captain Tom's 32 million, that's an incredible figure. But 32 million of a one-off campaign versus the 350 million that we were promised isn't acceptable. And loads of people who've donated to Captain Tom are like, oh, well, at least Captain Tom's happened. And it's like, well, no, actually, that leaves a £318 million deficit just in the week that that campaign was. I'm really impressed with myself with my quick maths there.
Quick maths.
I'm pretty impressed with that math, because you're explaining how dangerous that move is, how dangerous that kind of acceptance of this fundraising campaign was without thinking about what that actually means politically and what it is that the people, quote, the people are willing to accept from government, which is exactly why the U.S. is a shit show. It's exactly this kind of behavior from the very colonization of our country and the individualism that is more prevalent here that allows us to think about independent systems and not to think about any sort of coordinated care. For example, the shit show that is our vaccine rollout right now. The shit show that is our discrepancies between healthcare around COVID. Or even testing, right? Just all of that has been a huge mess in the United States as a result of exactly what you're speaking to, like being the standard and the status quo over here.
But it's tough though, right? Because when you look at the mess that is the US rollout of the COVID vaccine, and a charity are offering to do it better and you can donate to them, it does feel a little bit like what Tom and I are platforming right now is to just do nothing. And it's worth saying that that's very much not what we're saying. And it's tough because obviously our background is fixing fundraising. One of the key themes that comes up in fixing fundraising all the time is that fundraising in and of itself is not enough. And actually, maybe writing to your MP in the UK or writing to your senator or your congressman is a better use of your time, and actually being like, no, this isn't okay. I'm going to donate to the political party that's going to affect that change is a much better, if more convoluted, use of your time.
What is the next step for those of us that work in the nonprofit sector, for those of us who work in fundraising? Some parts of this podcast are about how we as fundraisers are contributing to the mess. Definitely, that's also part of the community-centric fundraising.org content hub. And the content that we put out through that is definitely about how we contribute to the problem. How do you think we can contribute to the solution? I think, Andy, you're pointing to what we can do as citizens in our respective countries, right? Like writing to our politicians, making political campaign contributions. What else y'all got? Tom?
Yeah, definitely being an active citizen. So it's making that distinction between being an active citizen as much as you can be and as consistently as you can be, and not just letting these kind of big movements that like Captain Tom, that kind of, they're very emotionally driven, they're very unique, and they kind of sweep you off your feet and you think that you can effect lasting change. But even if we look at that specific example of that £32 million going to a consortium of charities, the change that people think that they've enacted through doing that and the mechanism in which that money is going to get distributed is extremely inefficient versus taxation, right? Like taxation is a well-established, I will say it again, very boring way of funding your public services. But that money was all funded through a private company who set up a fundraising page, who would have taken some profit off the top. It would have then gone to another organization who then had to think about how they were going to distribute that money, which would have cost them a lot of money. It's a really expensive journey. So what I'd always ask people to do, and what I think, you know, as fundraisers, we have this duty to kind of help people make effective giving decisions so they can have the most impact. And often that is community centric, right? Often it is, how can you make a difference in your immediate environment, in your community, or whatever kind of connects you to other people. I think that consistency in your citizenry is really important. So not just being like getting involved in one thing, but having this politically active like mantra, I think, is so important, because it means you stay in the loop. You're not just moving from kind of one movement to another, or you don't set yourself up for disappointment if you give to a charity that ends up spending that money how you least expect it. And holding your leaders to account, obviously, this is kind of super important. As Andy said, you know, having that, even that basic level of political engagement, means you hold your leaders to account, and they're the people that, especially in this country, appoint the chair of the charity commission. So, you know, eventually you have some kind of influence over that decision making. If whether you're a fundraiser working on the front lines, or you are just a donor that, that wants to make a difference. So it's having that consistency, I think, is kind of super important, and knowing what you're getting involved in when you choose to give money.
The other angle to consider is, because that's what we can do as donors, right? But the other angle is what can we do as fundraisers? What can we do as people who work in charities?
Yeah, totally.
And one of the things that, that strikes me about particularly community-centric fundraising, but fundraising more generally, is that a lot of this is about realizing the power that you have and realizing the consequences of your actions. Yeah. So if you're a top-level leader, there's loads you can do. You can really assess your programs. You can really assess how your programs are working to meet needs. If your programs are meeting needs the best way they can be done. If you're considering the long term or just the short term, like, are you building a nursery? If you're building a nursery, what's the primary school going to be? That kind of question that's really important to ask. But also, even as a lower level or a junior member of staff, there's a lot you can do about questioning why we're doing this, being connected to your purpose, being connected to the problems that you're solving, and ensuring that the problem that you're solving is being solved in the best way for the people whose problem it is. There's loads of stuff, particularly in international development, speaking from the country that know colonialism best, international development communications can often be super colonial. Like, this poor little African person that we're going to help because they don't know this or that is deeply, deeply problematic. And if you look at your own comms that you're putting out, think, yes, this might be generating money, but is this doing more harm than good? And really kind of assessing that and taking that case to your manager or your manager's manager and boiling back down to, this is the reason our charity was set up. This is the problem that we are trying to solve. Are our actions not even doing more good than harm? That's not enough. Are our actions doing harm? Because if so, we are making our mission take longer than it needs to. And so it's really worth, as a fundraiser, as well as a donor, considering the messages you're putting out, the options you have, and using the power that you do have, particularly if you are privileged, like Tom and I have the, I guess, fortune, as gross a word as that is to use it to be. We are both middle-class white males. If we don't use our power, who the fuck will?
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that. And I agree with you. If you don't use your power for good, who the fuck will?
We're talking with the gentlemen of the Fixing Fundraising podcast, Andy King and Tom Dufresne, right now on The Ethical Rainmaker. Do you love the topics we're bringing you? The best way to support this pod is by subscribing, sharing with your colleagues, and contributing to our new Patreon. Learn more at theethicalrainmaker.com. All right, so let's talk about patronages. In the UK, members of the royal family have links with hundreds of charities, military associations, professional bodies, and public service organizations.
And for North American listeners, we can think of these patronages sort of like having a celebrity or a powerful or influential person associated with your nonprofit board. So, gentlemen, one of the things that we've talked about in our own conversations is the role of royalty as patrons. And, you know, the reason it interests me and I'm curious about it and how things are done in the UK is because I think we're mimicking a lot of your fundraising structures, especially that were created through the rule of monarchy. We're emulating them, and we may not even be clear that we're doing so. We're having some big issues with some of our patrons, for example, in the medical field. We have Zuckerberg Chan, for example, gaining criticism because they've given a huge gift to a Silicon Valley hospital. That hospital is now upset that they have to use the Zuckerberg Chan name as a result of this huge gift that was given, because hospital staff believe that Facebook was spreading a lot of misinformation about COVID. And so hospital staff are upset, for example, about the role of that patronage. That's a little bit abstract. I'm wondering if you would talk about, you know, how patronage and royalty works and what some of what we might be mimicking here in the US and what the problems are.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting one. It definitely is one of those antiquated things that just kind of exists. And there's lots of research that I know Andy can kind of talk about in more detail in terms of what it kind of means. But in terms of the way the royal family works and the way patronages work, the first recorded patronage, I believe this is right, was George II. So that is, he died 1760. So we're talking
deep
old school
in history.
Yeah. Yeah. We're digging into the time when they used to powder all their faces and have really curly, curly white hair. The proper Georgian times. The concept is that a royal patronage, either from the monarch, who his or her patronage carries like the most weight, the most influence. If you have a royal patronage from the monarch, it in theory unlocks more funding, more reputation, whatever it might be. And members of the royal family, right down to the kids, up to a certain point, they unlock these patronages as they kind of grow up, and they will become patrons of a charity. So whether it's Queen Victoria was the patron of the Mothers Union. I don't know what the Mothers Union is, but it sounds like something that probably shouldn't have existed. It sounds like a workhouse to me more than it sounds like anything that should have existed. And these patronages, essentially, they add status, right? And the royal family or the patron will visit the physical location, will maybe cut a ribbon, and it's designed to increase their kind of status. Basically, it's super problematic when you look at instances like Prince Andrew, who, you know, his fall from grace in the royal family caused a lot of controversy because he refused to give up his patronages for a while, and obviously he had a chat with his mum, and you know, she was like, you probably should give these up for the sake of the charities that you work for, and you know, it's not all about you, you selfish idiot. But it definitely is quite a problematic power structure that seems to have spread out across the world, and I think it really sets quite a weird example of like favoritism in the charity sector, and I think that can be quite dangerous. So it's certainly an interesting antiquated idea that we still use to this day.
Prince Andrew, just to be clear, his fall from grace had to do with pedophilia, right?
Yeah, correct. He was very good friends with Jeffrey Epstein, and there was a lot of controversy around his, you know, his actions around there. And he's immune from prosecution in the US because of his status. But, you know, if, for example, he was removed from the royal family, then he wouldn't retain that immunity. But he's essentially been ostracized by the royal family as a result of that. And for a long while, he wasn't giving up his he had a position in government, but he also had a position as a patron of multiple charities, and he wasn't giving up those patronages for quite a while. And obviously you can imagine the stress and anxiety it would have caused those organizations to have someone like that as their figurehead. So it's not a bulletproof system. And to some extent, it might even be seen as undesirable now for a lot of organizations.
And just to kind of show how low the benefit is versus how great the stress and the PR issue was with Prince Andrew. Tom mentioned that Prince Andrew was the patron of multiple charities. Guess how many charities he was legally registered as a patron as, Michelle. Take a guess.
No idea. I am unfamiliar with how this system works. 30?
How many charities do you think one person could reasonably be a patron of and actually make any difference?
maybe like 3, but I would say if they have lots of money, maybe like 30 or 40.
Cool. He was the patron of 203 charities.
Wow.
Which mm-hmm. just shows how much it's lip service and how much it's ego driven. It's really desirable from a board perspective to be the board of a charity that has an exciting patron. But there is countless research that shows, and this is a great title from the Times, one of our papers, that just says, having a royal patron doesn't pay for charities. And it shows that of 3,000 charities surveyed with a royal patron, it had a small or negative impact on their profits that year. It is completely about status and nothing about solving the problem that the charity was set up to solve. And kind of tying it into the political issue, it's super interesting to see which causes they are patrons of too, because they are patrons of cultural charities, sports charities, and basically nice to have charities, whereas social mobility charities have almost no royal patronage. They will only side themselves with the charities that are seen as nice to have or pure charity, whereas the ones that are more in the space of, oh, the state's not doing enough, so I'm going to set one up, they're not
like racial equity,
like
for
racial
example.
Equity.
They're
not interested in touching that, and the racial equity charities probably aren't interested in touching them either, because they see, I mean, using the word touching and Prince Andrew in the same concept is problematic at best, but yeah, it's not a great look for anyone involved.
No.
Got it. And so, you know, I think one question that's important to ask is, who is bringing on these patrons?
It's usually the board using their connections to try and secure something that they probably think is in the long term going to benefit them, but is more about, if you dig into it, probably board ego, Dan.
Yeah, it's definitely started to shift ever so slightly. Like in terms of, you look at someone like Prince William, who's, you know, positioned himself as a more modern member of the royal family. He is a patron for a charity called Centrepoint, which is a homelessness charity. So there is an almost inherent political statement in that. Whereas a lot of traditional patronages, because they go back to George II, they are inherited. So they're hereditary patronages. So the Queen will inherit her father's patronages, and really they'll just build up over time. And often there'll be areas that they're interested in. So, you know, Prince Charles, who's the Prince of Wales, is very interested in the environment, and he's been in lots of political scandals using his power to influence environmental policy. He chooses a lot of patronages in that area. So they seem to have some kind of correlation with their interests, if they express any interests. But a lot of them are hereditary. A lot of them are passed down, and they are, because these organizations, some of which go back hundreds of years, they are a royal institution because they've always had a patron who's the monarch, or a patron who is a crown prince or crown princess. So yeah, it's certainly become a problem that I guess it's just getting worse over time. It kind of exacerbates itself, but it is quite refreshing almost to see someone like Prince William who just goes, Centrepoint, that's what I'm into. Like I'm really into getting rid of homelessness, which I think is obviously, it's inherently political whether he gets involved in those conversations or not. And then you get people like Prince Harry, who's just like, I'm out of here. I'm done with this family. I'm taking my patronages with me and I'm going to America. But there we go. There we go. We can't keep them all,
Hollywood.
Can we? To Hollywood, baby.
Right. Hollywood. So a lot of the patronages are passed down then. They're hereditary. And then I'm also hearing that some of them are really boards seeking out patrons, and that whole system in general does more harm than good. Any solutions about how we shift the model?
I mean, first of all, ban hereditary patronages. That's just weird. There were lots of things that used to be passed down. Hereditary titles in the UK were common for a long time, like the House of Lords which is our equivalent of the Senate, used to be hereditary. So if you were appointed, because it's appointed, not elected, then your kids would also be appointed. also weird, but ignoring that. So do away with hereditary patronages. And then I think it's just about ensuring that if your cause is going to go for a patron, you go for someone that A, has a genuine interest, and B, is in a position to use their power for good. And I've seen some incredible patronages. There's a blood cancer charity that I do some work with, and they have a comedian patron. And that comedian is known for being a pub landlord comic. Tom can probably guess who that is. It's a very British reference. But that pub landlord comic has been incredible at introducing that blood cancer charity to beer brands. Because if that comic reaches out to a beer brand, you better believe they reply. And given how much alcohol is linked to causing cancer, collaborating with those beer brands on alcohol-free beers, which also gives a kickback to the charity, is a really positive angle. But
fascinating.
But that's like one example of where it does work. But it's just making sure that you do less better rather than more worse, if that makes sense.
100%.
Wow. Thank you for talking to us a little bit about how all of that works. I think for all of us listening in other places, we can also see how the role of the board is important in upholding some of these terrible practices, and also the ways in which we could shift the model if we chose to. Well, gentlemen, that's it for our discussion with Tom Dufresne and Andy King of Fixing Fundraising. Thank you so much for being on The Ethical Rainmaker. It is such a pleasure to speak with you both. And thank you again for your work. I look forward to staying connected.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle. It was a blast.
That's a wrap for our first episode of Season 2 of The Ethical Rainmaker. I'm Michelle Shirin Miri. And you can hear Lottie the dog snoring in the background. Thank you so much again for joining us. We have extensive show notes for this episode on the complex systems of patronage and charities in the UK and everything we mentioned at theethicalrainmaker.com. And we're self-funded. So if you'd like to contribute financially to this beautiful series, you can find us on Patreon. Thank you to our very newest patrons, Kim, Rocky, Andrea, Jill, Zoe, Shayna, Rebecca, Liberty, Rachel, Nancy, Tally, Heather, Julie, Chelsea, and Vu. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast so we can count you in. And while you're at it, think about suggesting the show to a few friends or coworkers you think would enjoy it. It really helps us get the word out. The Ethical Rainmaker is produced and edited in Seattle, Washington by Isaac Kaplan-Wolner with socials by Rochelle Pierce. This pod is sponsored by Freedom Conspiracy, my fundraising consulting collective, which you can find at freedom-conspiracy.com. Special thanks to Trick Candles for letting us use their beautiful song. It's so catchy. I'm gold. Find a link to their Bandcamp in our show notes as well. And that's it for The Ethical Rainmaker. See you in 2 weeks. You're going to love what's next. And in the meantime, take care of yourself.